Good morning, and welcome to Inquisitive Minds, a new show on Rock Radio CFU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each Wednesday morning, at this time, we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we hear about a report to be released shortly by the Ministry of Education on results of FDK, or full-day kindergarten, already in many Ontario schools, and soon to be rolled out throughout the rest of the province. Brock University opened their new BioLink facility, operated by the Goodman School of Business, last week, and we'll find out more about that. We'll find out just what it is and how it works from the Dean of the Goodman School of Business. And the annual Niagara Wine Festival is underway. So that will be the subject of our third conversation this morning. We'll be talking with a couple of Brock University geography professors, two-thirds of the team that didn't exactly write the book on Niagara Wine, but they edited one. Inquisitive Minds is on the air. Our first conversation this morning takes us back to kindergarten. I don't know about you, but I have vivid memories to this day of my very first day in kindergarten. Not pleasant ones. All the time I spent there, when I finally got there, not that bad. It was, in fact, the first walk to Lord Roberts Public School in Scarborough I remember the most. My mum dragging a crying and screaming kid all the way down the street, eventually handing me off to one of the students from, I think, grade 6, to take me the rest of the way through the schoolyard. Maybe that day explains a lot about my formative years, but no matter. I'm sure we all have stories of our first day in kindergarten. Ontario's Ministry of Education continues to roll out plans to have full-day kindergarten available in all the province's elementary schools next year. It is already available in many, of course, and the complete rollout comes following the outcome of a 2-year study examining the implementation of the FDK program and the benefits to children's social and cognitive development. The Ministry of Education is expected to release a full report by the end of this month or the beginning of next month. Brock University Associate Professor specializing in early childhood education, Mary Louise Vanderlee, took a leadership role in the research, and as the study's co-principal evaluator, she is certainly well-positioned to discuss the findings of the study with us this morning. Mary Louise joined us in the studio recently, and we began by discussing her own early childhood experiences in kindergarten.
Well, that was so far in my history. I do remember the children in the classroom, the teacher, and it being a very pleasant experience. And in fact, I remember some children very well and some of the experiences very well. But as I say, most of it was quite pleasant.
What is going on in kindergarten beyond the playtime? Because I remember plasticine, I remember painting, I remember nap time. I always enjoyed nap time. But they're learning things. What are they learning in those first months going into kindergarten?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I think for the most part, the goals of the teachers in those classrooms are to help children adjust to the school. So adjusting to some of the routines, some of the expectations, and engaging in behaviors that are very pro-social in nature.
What are the important things that they're learning in those first experiences that will ultimately chart the course for the rest of their school years, their formative years? It's obviously more than just, for want of a better expression, daycare.
The learning experiences that are provided by the classroom teachers really are intended to engage the children to build that foundation of understanding. So by engaging in water play, sand play, and I know I'm using the word play because that's what it's about, is a play-based program, is to introduce them into engaging with the resources in the classroom to help them understand the characteristics of those resources, how those resources can be put together and manipulated, and how they can create something with them.
The playtime, yeah, that is key, because you can't throw them into a work regimen right away, because obviously the first few years of their lives, they've had nothing but playtime, and they've learned a lot of things at home, but playtime is integral, so you can't take that away from them in the early going, can you?
Absolutely not. One shouldn't take that away from them. But I would also like to say that a lot of the pre-reading skills, the pre-math skills, are actually acquired through engaging in play. Some of it may be child-directed, child-selected, and some of it is teacher-directed. So again, play is a big part of it, but their exposure to those learning opportunities are really enhanced when it's a well-planned environment for the children.
Half-day kindergarten is what most of us grew up with. We've got now, in a lot of the schools in Ontario, full-day kindergarten. With the findings released by the Ministry of Education, how much of an impact does full-day kindergarten have on the children?
Well, we're finding out that it has a substantial impact, and certainly there has been a release of data to talk about the early development inventory, which looks at the various domains of development of the children and where they're standing in terms of risk factors. So children should be developing in a certain manner to allow them to get the most out of learning opportunities. And when we see that the full day learning is actually decreasing the percentage of children demonstrating risk factors, then we can see that the full day early learning is truly having an impact on allowing children to gain the most they can out of those learning opportunities.
The study was conducted over a 2-year period. How was the data collected over that 2-year period then?
Well, there were a couple of things. We did case studies on a variety of schools where we actually went into the schools, we observed the classrooms, we interviewed the educators in the classrooms, the principals, we had focus groups with the parents, we spoke with the children and engaged them in an activity ourselves to collect some of our data. And then again, we had the early development inventory, which was administered through the typical sources that it is. This has been ongoing since 2000. So it just became part of the process of what we do. So we didn't do anything very differently except sought parental permission to engage children in that process.
What did the results that come out of the study tell us?
Well, it's telling us that there's a lot of good things happening. Now, these results are early, but it is showing us that children who are engaged for the full day are tending to be more on task, have longer periods of time to engage in the learning activities, and are showing some benefits from that engagement compared to children in the half-day programs. And part of that has been released through the ministry in terms of the EDI data.
Now, the government has taken a fair amount of flack for implementing the full-day kindergarten, even to the point that we're at now. Do the study findings vindicate the government's decision, do you think, to implement full-day kindergarten?
I think they are definitely supportive of the initiative, and it is showing strong outcomes. And I think the other thing that it's doing is it's adding to what we already know. There is a great deal of research going on among other researchers that parallels to some extent some of what we did, but what we're finding is there's congruency in what we're finding. So not only did we find these things, but other researchers such as Jen Peltier from the University of Toronto, OISE, they're finding similar patterns of outcomes that are very beneficial.
Let's talk about EDI, the Early Development Instrument, which is a UNESCO-reviewed measurement of early childhood development. What areas are examined, and how is that data that you acquire, how is that interpreted?
There are 5 domains of development. So we're looking at the cognitive, at the language, at the socio-emotional, and at the physical development of the child. And this measure is used to determine how a community is doing in supporting the development of children. So when we use this tool, it's not necessarily an individual measure, but it allows us to compare groups against each other to see the overall impact of community resources, and in this case, with the full-day early learning, compare the outcomes of children in the full day after a full year to children who have spent half a day. So the way that the implementation of the full-day early learning kindergarten program has rolled out across Ontario allows for this comparison to happen. I think the other piece that we can look at is because of having the information on over approximately 700 children, we can track their outcomes over time. So in looking at how they did as a group in the early years, compare it to the EQAO results in grade 3, grade 6, grade 9, we can track these children over time. And I think this is the largest cohort that we've ever had in Canada in terms of tracking children's development.
I didn't realize two educators were in classes with 16 or more children. And again, that's something I'd never experienced years ago. How is that affected by FDK? Does that have any bearing on it at all?
Well, in terms of the implementation of this program, it was designed to create the most supportive environment for children beginning their schooling, but also to think about how to integrate before and after care within the programs so that children are not bounced around from environment to environment, because we know parents often work longer days than the school day occurs. So in thinking about creating that integrated full day of early learning and care, having the two educators in the classroom is a particular bonus. Number one, we have an Ontario certified teacher, and the partner is a registered early childhood educator. So they each bring particular strengths to the classroom, and they each bring whatever knowledge they are coming in with about child development. And certainly that is a strength to have the two adults in the classroom with a group of children.
I always remember finding half-day kindergarten, then going to grade one, was like night and day.
Mm-hmm.
It was going from a mildly learning experience to a much more structured experience. So how does FDK, full-day kindergarten, better prepare them for the elementary school curriculum?
Well, that's an excellent question. And what we are anticipating is there's going to be changes occurring in the grade one classroom because of the full day early learning. And the reason I say that is because of their experiences, because of the full day, because of the advances they are making, they're going to have to do things differently in grade one to be ready to move the children forward. So we are hoping that the ideas around the pedagogy really shift what has typically gone on in a grade one classroom. So we're hoping to move the good practices up. And it's not that there's not good practices happening, but we have to think about, again, the best way to support all children. And if we want to do that, we have to think about the best practices for young children and to distinguish between children in childcare versus children in the school system. Quite often we're dealing with the same age children. So we need to engage in best practices.
Because of FDK, would there be an increased demand for early childhood educators because there is simply more time and has to be devoted to educating these young children?
Absolutely. With the continued rollout and all schools offering full-day early learning in the next year, 2014, September, there will be a demand for more early childhood educators in the classrooms to accommodate all the children who will be coming into those programs.
But do the qualifications needed change at all?
For the early childhood educator?
Yeah.
They need to be registered early childhood educators. Now, the question is, do we have enough of them? and can they fill those positions? There are many programs across Ontario that students enroll in to get their early childhood education diploma, and whether or not we will have enough is yet to be seen, but it also has implications for the childcare sector, who continue to offer care for infants and toddlers and preschoolers. So we don't want to pull everyone out who is really well experienced into the school environments. We want to make sure we have some really wonderful, great folks left for the childcare sector as well. So having that balance is really, really important, but certainly, there are implications for positions, and certainly through human nature, we want a position to be well, we want to work in a job that pays us well. We want that. And certainly working with the school system may have implications in terms of wages as opposed to working in a childcare sector.
How does junior kindergarten come into play here? Is that part of the full-day kindergarten curriculum as well?
Well, what we have is a two-year kindergarten program. So the fact that in the past we've called it junior and senior was a way to identify which year the child was in. I don't know if folks will continue to use that terminology, but in reality, the full-day early learning kindergarten program is a two-year program. So children can start the program at 4 years and continue till they're five and then move into grade one. So they have 2 years to reach all the outcomes that are within the kindergarten curriculum guides.
So what we're looking at is a two-year full-day education program before grade one even begins.
Mm-hmm.
What's being taught in full-day that couldn't be achieved with just the half-day kindergarten and the JK?
More time spent on those experiences, more time to read stories, more time to engage in music, more time to engage in mathematical activities. And of course, we know it's not necessarily subject-oriented, but there's more integration of these areas over a longer period of time. So simply expanding the day, the opportunities for the children to engage. Again, it has more to do with time than it does with what's being done.
So in other words, taking what you're already doing and expanding it.
Absolutely.
So you've got the luxury of time.
Yes.
To delve more into these and educate them over a longer period of time.
Absolutely. And again, it allows children to engage in these activities to a deeper degree because they're not asked to move to the next thing that the teacher needs to cover for the curriculum. So it allows them to engage and become more creative and become deeper thinkers about what they're doing and having more time to reflect on what they're doing and engage in more one-to-one conversation with the teachers in the classroom and allow for more opportunity for small group activities to take place. So whether it be trying to write and maintain a little journal with the children, again, reading stories and asking children questions in smaller groups to really allow each child the opportunity to speak and express their understanding. These are all important aspects of the full day.
Now, when the full report comes out, either late September, early October, can you give us any idea what else will be in the full report that we haven't already gleaned from what's been released so far?
Well, there's a lot of detail in the report. We looked at so many things. If we think about the kindergarten curriculum, there are a lot of program areas. And one of the biggest shifts is the teaching team and how the team works together and how important it is for the implementation of the curriculum as it was intended. And when we have teachers who have been used to working independently in their classroom, now having a partner, it's kind of like a marriage, right? You need to get used to your partner, figure out what pieces of the program each of you attend to, how you share what you do, how you share information about the children. So it's a wonderful opportunity to really strengthen both educators who are working together and really acknowledging the strengths that they bring to the classroom.
Thank you very much for coming into the studio this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
Brock University Associate Professor Mary Louise Vanderlee, who specializes in early childhood education, on the rollout of full-day kindergarten here in Ontario. And you're listening to Inquisitive Minds, a presentation of Brock Radio, CFBU-FM. Last Wednesday, Brock University celebrated the grand opening of their new BioLink facility, operated by the Goodman School of Business, as part of Innovate Niagara's network of incubators, which aims to join students, researchers, and private sector entrepreneurs to help bring life sciences, biosciences, and similar concepts to market. The facility is located in the university's Cairns Family Health and Bioscience Research Complex, a 4,000-square-foot chunk of real estate at Brock that includes various labs and research infrastructure, meeting rooms, and offices, all designed to bring these new concepts to the fore. BioLink also received an $843,000 startup contribution from the Federal Economic Development Agency for Southern Ontario. Donald Sear is the dean of the Goodman School of Business at Brock and joined us in the studio recently to discuss BioLink, and we began at the beginning. What is BioLink?
Fundamentally, BioLink is a business incubator. Its main focus or primary focus is biotechnology or innovations and businesses that are focused on biotechnology, but it also has a general business incubator focus. And so what it does is it provides resources and opportunities for individuals that have an innovative idea to build upon that idea, research it, and hopefully commercialize it.
Is it all that unusual to have an operation such as BioLink as part of a business school?
Yes, it is. I think that that's been a mistake, though, and particularly in Canada. It's interesting to see the statistics around innovation and entrepreneurship in general. Compared to the United States, Canadians have just as many patents and innovations per capita as the United States, and yet where we tend to fall down is in the area of commercialization. And so I think this is going to be great that BioLink is being operated by the Goodman School of Business, because I think that we will fundamentally be able to bring a focus on commercialization and bring to the table the tools and knowledge that will facilitate commercialization for these innovative ideas.
Is there a sort of a missing link to deal with when bringing new innovative products to market in this country that basically BioLink is going to try to rectify?
Well, certainly the biotechnology field is something that I think we can build on here at Brock. We do have some strengths. I think that it's a growing field, and of course, it ties in nicely with the agricultural focus of the Niagara region. So I think there's a lot of synergies there. But as I said, BioLink is also has the ability to incubate businesses of just about any nature.
Is this why some new innovations don't make it ultimately, because the incubation process simply isn't always available?
Yes, oftentimes that's true. And even from established firms, and this is one of the areas that BioLink will provide opportunities for as well, is that somebody within an established firm may have a great idea. However, the ability of the firm to set resources aside to focus on that innovation aspect, that research aspect, is sometimes limited. And so BioLink has the ability to provide some space and some resources tied in to the university that even an existing firm could perhaps utilize and set up an individual and perhaps a couple of other individuals there, whereas their own operations may not be capable of that ability.
So take me through the process here. If I were to come to you with an idea, how far does my development process have to be before BioLink would come into play?
Well, we do have some checks and balances that firms go through, largely through Innovate Niagara that BioLink is associated with. So we are looking for innovative ideas that look and have the potential, or at least in the long term, to be commercialized. There's also focus on employment around these ideas, so that becomes the priority. We do have a great residency advisory board that we've just established, and it, of course, has made its first decisions with regards to residents in BioLink. A great group, great team, all kinds of experience brought to the table, and so I'm really happy about that.
Can you tell us more about the team that's involved with BioLink?
Yeah, I do. I can tell you about the members of them. Nick DiPietro, one of the Board of Trustees members at Brock, is chair of the BioLink Residency Advisory Board. He's an accomplished entrepreneur in the pharmaceutical industry. He established a firm, Patheon, and he's now president and CEO of Natacor Inc., a venture capital management services company. Ian Brindle from Brock University, professor emeritus in chemistry, former dean of the faculty and vice president of research, and currently a special advisor to the president's office, so a longtime member of Brock and in the chemistry field. David Anion is chair of the Goodman School of Business Advisory Council, and Mr. Anion is a successful entrepreneur in the manufacturing industry, former president and CEO of Vintex, and he was a finalist for the Canadian Business Entrepreneur of the Year Awards. Ernst & Young runs. Marnie Levine is Associate Vice President for Economic Development at the University of Buffalo, and she spent more than 25 years in private and public sectors, creating new products and startup businesses, healthcare, life sciences, and she's been associated with a similar type of incubator at SUNY. John Sook is Chair-Elect of the Board of Universities Board of Trustees. John, of course, is an entrepreneur also in the pharmaceutical industry, former president and CEO of Nycomed Canada, president of the consulting firm Exigera. John Zonkley is a member of the Goodman School of Business Advisory Council as well. He's a graduate of the Goodman School in 1986. He was named the Business School's Distinguished Graduate in 2008. And, of course, just this Saturday, he was named the Brock University Alumni Association's Distinguished Alumnus. He currently oversees the administrative and financial functions for his family-run operation and 9 Tim Horton franchises in the region. Martin Philp is a graduate also of the Goodman School, and Marty is director of Kilbride Partners. He's a corporate veteran with Ingersoll Rand, has had a lot of experience with turnarounds and restructurings, and basically is involved in the private equity industry. John Wilson is on the board. He's director of innovation commercialization at Brock, and finally myself as well.
Now, are there any restrictions as to what can be incubated with ThiaLink?
Well, not really, as long as we are able to hold up our end and be able to provide the potential resources and space that would be needed. We have 3 laboratories within BioLink. One is fully outfitted with fume hood, etc. They have across the hall sort of matching rooms, computer equipped so that individuals can undertake some research and studies and record data or move back and forth between the lab easily and the computer. There's other spaces within BioLink for those innovative ideas that are not perhaps requiring necessarily that much lab space or perhaps limited lab space. We have collaborative areas, particularly for students who might have some innovative ideas that want to be able to work with other students. Located in the BioLink is also, we've moved our Goodman School of Business Consulting Group, student consulting group, which is made up of MBA students and fourth-year undergraduate students, has been carrying on consulting services largely in the Niagara region. That group is also located in BioLink, and that's a very distinct strategy that will enable them to interface with the residents of BioLink easily. We also have the Goodman School. We also have a very significant service learning component that we operate. One of our first MBA graduates, Gillian Kemp, is our service learning coordinator. Gillian has worked a lot with the nonprofits and increasingly small business entrepreneurs, where students are in groups, work on projects as part of a course, so more like a course project. She will line students up with specific needs of those nonprofit organizations and small business. And we definitely see the service learning that is offered by Goodman as an opportunity for students also to interface with these BioLink residents and provide them with some services.
Now, do the incubated ideas have to originate at Brock, or can they come from outside the university?
No, they can come from outside. So we're looking for ideas that fit within these broad themes of what we've talked about. There is a, not necessarily a priority, but we'd certainly like to see ideas that come from the Brock community. But as I mentioned, we also see the possibility of firms that come from the outside, may not have had a connection with Brock before, but we'll be able to have some synergy by working with individuals perhaps at Brock.
So who would the target residents for BioLink be then?
Well, our target residents, again, in the very first instance, was in the biotechnology area. We have, the advisory committee has approved 3 firms for residency now in the BioLink, and so we're ironing out such things as residency agreements, etc. Trivium Industries is an individual, the president of that is David D'Angelo. He was a Brock graduate, took a lot of business courses. David competed, interestingly enough, in the West Nickel Entrepreneurship Competition, which is a national competition sponsored by Mr. West Nickel. And David, his idea was a corn-based, biodegradable, and more importantly, compostable materials that started out. The idea first was utensils, knives and forks, etc., but has morphed into looking at containers that might be used, for example, in the cosmetic industry, which are, again, made of this corn-based substance, which is compostable. The idea of compostability is very important as opposed to biodegradable. You can certainly have something that is listed as biodegradable that takes 50 years to biodegrade. Compostable means it's going to go in there and it's going to be gone pretty quick. So he's moving in to look at development of a coating to coat the inside of his containers, which will allow them to be resilient until the point that they are composted. And of course, what he's working on is the idea around you want them to be able to store materials that might trigger off that degrading. You need something that will enable that not to happen until the outside of the container, in a sense, is exposed and begins to biodegrade. Regenestem, that's a firm, again, coming from the outside, looking at the clinical processing and preservation platforms of stem cells. Regenestem is looking at ways to store our stem cells and regenerative cells. So in a sense, providing some bioinsurance for future needs. Jason Kane's the president chairman. And they're working in conjunction with Dr. Jeff Stewart, who's an associate professor in Brock's Biological Science Department. So there the synergy, again, is with Brock, and Jeff will be carrying out some research in conjunction with them. Exact Delivery is a lipid technology platform company that looks at new technologies for the health and hygiene sectors. And interestingly enough, that the company is, the president of the company is a current Brock physics PhD student, Drew Marquette. And so he's using one of the labs for his work and hoping to develop something that is market-driven and commercialization. It is interesting that, as I was saying, if you look at the number of innovations, patents, etc. that we have in Canada, it is just as much per capita as the U.S., but it's on that commercialization side that we fall down. The other interesting statistic is that when you look at senior management in general within our business community, a much lower number of them, much lower rate, have had formal business training than in the United States. And so again, the idea is we're hoping to be able to set up programs that will provide that type of training for individuals to give them the background in a lot of times and just sort of basic business education and knowledge that will allow us to take somebody who has a very science background and provide them with the tools to be able to understand the process of commercialization and for it to be a success.
I would imagine for the students, this is an amazing opportunity to be involved in something so cutting edge, so forward thinking that's going on here with BioLink.
Oh, for sure. And this year coming up is going to be exciting. You know, the BioLink facility came in once Goodman came involved, which was really operationally only in January, and now the facility has come in ahead of time and slightly under budget, but that was only June, really. And so now we have three firms moving in, and over this coming year, we're hoping to put in place the type of programs that will result in engagement of students of all different types around Brock University with BioLink. We want to get our business faculty, of course, and a number of them are already involved in looking at or facilitating some endeavors that might become residents of BioLink, and of course our service learning students and certainly the business consulting students as well.
When a concept makes its way through BioLink and graduates, if you will, from the incubation process, what's the support mechanism available to an entrepreneur as that concept is launched into the marketplace?
You know, that's also part of the larger Innovate Niagara consortium that has been formed and involves Niagara College, us, and of course the former NGEN here downtown. And these are all incubators, and Innovate, and particularly through its website, will be able to provide access to individuals as they go through the process of building a business. And that's the hope. And certainly our connection with residents, and as you suggest, as they graduate, we hope doesn't end there. Of course, we're looking at being able to structure all types of different agreements with potential residents. Some of the services we might provide may have rent associated. Some may be free if, in the case of, we think there's a student entrepreneur that has some hope that we think ties in nicely with BioLink. We will also be looking at intellectual property agreements that may result in us having a revenue sharing with the individual or organization as it graduates.
We're talking with Don Sear, the dean of the Goodman School of Business at Brock. How much of a factor does the Niagara location play in the growth of the biosciences? Are there advantages to incubating here rather than elsewhere?
I think for the longer term, that truly is a potential. Of course, we have quite a substantial greenhouse industry, which could be involved in biotechnology as ideas and innovations get launched. We, of course, have an agricultural industry that is very strong regardless, and, of course, is looking at ways in which it can diversify and survive economically. We have a great region here, and particularly for agriculture, and biotechnology is a growing area with incredible opportunity, and it only makes perfect sense that we're a region that perhaps in time can be having or taking a lead in this.
I was going to ask then, is Niagara the next great frontier when it comes to new innovations?
Well, we hope that we're going to be contributing to that.
Don, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you, sir.
That was Donald Sear, dean of the Goodman School of Business, talking to us about Brock's new BioLinks facility, part of Innovate Niagara's network of innovators that opened last week. Incidentally, I always find the conversations following the interviews to be just as interesting as the interviews themselves. And afterwards, I found out Don likes to play jazz piano in his spare time, and in fact, plays every Friday evening at a place in Chippewa. Who knew? He takes requests, by the way. Just don't ask him to play Melancholy Baby. I tried that already. The Niagara Wine Festival kicked off last Friday at Montebello Park. If you are like me of a certain vintage, you recall when it was the Niagara Grape and Wine Festival. In keeping with the celebration of the Niagara wine industry now underway, we here at Inquisitive Minds raise a collective glass of the fermented grape, even at this hour, to a tradition of local winemaking older than you might think, and growing by leaps and bounds with new wineries coming online almost monthly, it seems. But is it all bright and rosy, or rosé? The world of Niagara wine is described as a transdisciplinary exploration of the Niagara wine industry. Published by Wilfrid Laurier University Press, the book brings together several writers offering their take on our local industry in a number of essays written by several authors and edited by three faculty members in the Department of Geography at Brock University, Michael Ripmeester, Philip Gordon McIntosh, and Christopher Fullerton. Professors Ripmeester and Fullerton joined us in the studio recently to talk about all things wine in Niagara.
In the preface of the book, you're described as deeply curious academics. I didn't realize there were any other kind.
Well, there probably aren't, but we are, well, I can't speak for Chris or for Phil, who is the other editor of this volume, but curious about the region, curious about the things that go on here, curious about the wine industry. Both Chris and I and Phil have long-standing interests in things that are perhaps sometimes tangential to the wine industry, but nonetheless, there's a key component that ties it all together.
Now, the wine industry in Niagara, let's talk about that. The local wine industry is not really all that old. When you come right down to it, how old, in fact, is the local wine industry here?
It depends on what you mean by that. The first chapter of the book is written by one of our colleagues, Alan Hughes, who sadly passed away a few months ago. But Alan does a fantastic job of looking at, for lack of a better word, the roots of the grape and wine industry in the Niagara region. And he gets it right back to the early days. I can't remember dates offhand, but it's certainly early 1800s. The wine industry gets various starts along the way in terms of saleable product. Brights is one of them. Baby Duck is another one that were very popular. But when the vineyard owners or the farmers start to change over from, what was it, Chris, do you remember?
To the vinifera grapes, that's right. That was where it really started, was when they started to introduce those varietals.
Okay, so let's move on to how important the wine industry is. to the local economy. How big a deal is it?
Oh, it's very big. It's very big. I mean, given how many sort of changes that Niagara has seen over the past couple or three decades, you know, I mean, for example, over a 20-year period from the 80s to the early 2000s, Niagara lost about half of its manufacturing jobs, from going from about 47,000 in the mid-80s through to about 25,000 in the mid-2000s. So that's a lot of jobs being lost. And at the same time, a lot of those sort of factory jobs were connected to the agricultural industry, for example, with the Cadbury Schweppes closure in St. Catharines in the late 2000s and also the CanGrow Foods closure in St. David's. A lot of farmers lost the buyers for their tender fruit and juice grapes, and so they've also had to adapt. And so we've got this loss of manufacturing employment, we've got this loss or this sort of economic hit in the agricultural industry, and many different municipalities throughout Niagara are looking to the wine industry as one of the sort of potential saviors to sort of help sort of compensate for the job losses, the agricultural sort of shortcomings, and these sorts of things. So it's becoming, as we call it in the intro to our book, sort of one of the economic linchpins of the economy.
The other thing is that, and this is the research that I do with my colleague Russell Johnson, who's in the Department of Popular Culture, Film, and Communications. We're looking at the way in which wine has become part of the heritage of the region. And one of the things that we were amazed at was when we asked people in St. Catharines, what was the first thing that you think when you mention the word Niagara? It's not the falls, it's wine and grapes, which we found to be absolutely shocking. And we've done research in across the Niagara Peninsula now, asking the same kinds of questions. And it's definitely top of mind in the northern tier, so below the escarpment. Less so above the escarpment, but it's less visible there because the climate and the soils are not as good for grape growing. But people there are very aware of the potential for building on the grape and wine industry, even in places like Port Colborne and Fort Erie, where we did do some interviewing. So it's really important in terms of not only the economic side, but also in terms of regional psyche, what people are connecting to.
Is the Niagara wine industry being as successful as they could be to market themselves outside the region?
Well, I think the biggest keys there is just the reputation of the wines themselves. And we've certainly seen this huge, huge improvement over the past couple of decades in terms of the quality of the wine, the number of wines that are winning international awards at competitions and that sort of thing. And that's clearly the best form of advertising for the Niagara wine industry. But even beyond that, in terms of more traditional marketing practices, I think, you know, as the wine industry grows, we're hitting close to 100 wineries in Niagara now, and they either individually or collectively are really organizing well to market themselves. And I think, you know, it's going to continue to grow, and the awareness, not only locally and nationally, but internationally, is just going to keep growing.
And I was just going to add, in terms of an empirical example, one of my colleagues was at a winery and talking to some of the employees there. And they mentioned to him that most of their visitors come from places like Toronto and Ottawa. So there's definitely word out there that Niagara wineries are worth visiting and that the wines are worth drinking.
Compared to other wine-producing regions of the world, is Niagara's climate about as good as it would get for a quality wine?
We're not sort of the climatological experts, per se, of the wine industry locally, but certainly from my understanding, it is among sort of the best situated locations in the world for grape growing and winemaking. And with global climate change happening, incidentally, some of the more traditional and very, very long-standing wine regions of the world are seeing their conditions change, where it's not quite as conducive as it used to be to growing optimum grapes and wine as a result. So, I mean, it's not to say that climate change is a good thing, but it seems as though that may be influencing the long-term potential here as well.
But certainly in terms of the sort of traditional red and white wines, but I think the other thing when you mentioned climate change, Chris, is the concern over what's going to happen with the signature ice wines. There needs to be a number of days where things are frozen before the grapes can be harvested, and I think there's some concern that that minimum number of really, really cold days is shrinking. And so the signature wine, and again, I'm not a climatologist and I'm not sort of a vintner, but from what I hear, there's some concern over whether or not the cold winters are going to be cold enough for the continued production of these first-rate ice wines.
The other concern I would have is the development in and around Niagara. You go along the QEW and you see new developments, housing developments, for example, going up all the time. Is there an encroachment issue at play here as far as the wine industry is concerned? Could it be conceivable at some point that the wine industry could get pushed out of the very area where it was born?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's something that, again, in my chapter and also in Hugh Gaylor's chapter about sort of preserving the agricultural land base for the wine industry in Niagara, which is part of the latter part of the book. It's a big question, but fortunately, one of the sort of things that will hopefully serve to protect the lands for the vineyards and the wineries and such is the Greenbelt. The Greenbelt being in place in Ontario for several years now has sort of made it impossible for municipalities to rezone agricultural lands for urban uses like industry or housing. So much of the sort of best wine grape growing sections of Niagara are already protected in that way. But it's still an issue. Anytime you have urban encroachment right next to vineyards, or if you have highways passing through vineyards, there are sort of environmental concerns that can affect the quality of the grapes as they grow, that sort of thing. And even more beyond just the growing of the grapes, one of the other things that makes a wine region well known is what we call the winescape, the sort of visual and aesthetic charm of the area. And so when people come to Niagara looking for wine, not only are they looking for bottles of wine, they're looking for this winescape, this attractive, natural and sort of rural environment that has the vineyards, the wineries, the sort of quaint country roads, that sort of thing. And so that's probably a bigger concern. I mean, if the QEW, for example, is going to be widened to 6 lanes across, which is likely to happen in the next few years and that sort of thing, that will have an impact, not necessarily preventing the growth of a lot of grapes, but it could just affect the image of the area from a sort of winescape perspective.
What about the corporate ownership of the wineries? There was a time when a lot of the wineries that sprang up were locally owned small outfits that would grow, but that's not so much the case now. Is that a concern as far as the local wine industry is concerned?
Well, I think so. When Russell Johnson and I did our interviews, there were a lot of people, particularly in Grimsby and Virgil, who were concerned about the transition not only from family-run farms to corporate-run farms, but also the transition from tender fruits to vineyards. And a lot of people expressed some regret at the fact that the soft fruit orchards were being torn up and replaced by vineyards, owned often by people who were not local. So for them, there was element of heritage in the landscape that was being removed and replaced by something that people really didn't have an attachment for or with. So people also talk about the local farmers and their ability to grow grapes that meet the standards of the wineries. A few years ago, and I'm not sure what the situation has been recently, but I guess there were tons and tons of local grapes that were not used, and juice was being brought in from other places, and you get those cellared in Canada wines, which is a contentious thing. Again, it's not one of those areas in which I would claim expertise, but it's something that you hear when you interview people and when you read the local newspapers. So it's another question that would require a little bit more research. But is it a problem? Well, if enough local people think it is, it probably should be considered a problem.
Wine and culinary tourism seems to be the big thing now. Almost every winery is promoting it. And of course, the Niagara Wine Route will be coming right through the heart of downtown St. Catharines before too very long. Is this the next great frontier for the local wine industry, marketing Niagara as a destination stop for those who love the good wine and the good food that goes with it?
Absolutely. I think so. Chris can say more about tourism and economic development, and especially in the rural side, than I can. But it's certainly something that when you look at the winery's websites, when you look at the local economic development sort of plans for the future, you can see that a lot of it is tied to the combination of wine with other things. And I think you could probably make a good case for tying the wine industry and culinary tourism to the Performing Arts Center downtown, to the Spectator facility, to the movement of Brock's visual arts and dramatic arts downtown. They are looking to provide tourists with a sort of unique experience based around boutique shops, good food, arts and culture as well as wine. And like you mentioned, the grape route is going to be right through the middle of downtown. So I imagine that the people who are in charge of such things are thinking that this is all good links, that people will maybe stay at a winery or stay somewhere downtown and then make forays out into the countryside and do wine tastings and shop and go to a show in the evening. So I think you're absolutely right that these are important things.
I would agree 100%. I think the wine tourism industry and these sort of associated sectors like culinary tourism and agritourism and so on have a great future in Niagara. They potentially could also contribute a great deal to the sort of economic renaissance of the region post-manufacturing and as agriculture restructures. And it even has the potential to help places like Niagara Falls. Sort of the traditional anchor for tourism in Niagara is, of course, the falls themselves and the city of Niagara Falls. But we've even seen in that city that the tourism numbers have gone down in over the past decade or so. You know, it was as high as 16 million visitors a year. And post-2001, it went down to about 11 million visitors a year. And so even with the new casinos there in recent memory and sort of the newer attractions there, getting more people to come to Niagara for not just the falls, not just the casinos, but also for the wine-related tourism, chances are people, if they're coming for the wineries, will also go to those destinations too. So the whole region stands to benefit from the enhanced tourism development that comes with the wine economy.
But does that not in some way leave Niagara vulnerable to becoming too obsessed, if you will, to the wine industry, so it becomes, shall we say, too important to the local economy?
That's always a big risk, and that's something that I think myself and many of our colleagues who've contributed to this book have argued in different ways in our papers, or in our chapters, that the wine economy is growing, and it's clearly going to make a very important contribution to the region's overall economy and economic development in the next several decades. But it can't be all things to all people. There are many people, for example, who've been displaced by the closure of manufacturing facilities where they simply won't be qualified to take new jobs that come in the tourism sector or in the winemaking sector. And so those people can't be forgotten. We need to make sure that there's a good diversification of the regional economy beyond just wine so that it's less vulnerable to any sort of shocks, such as a very poor year where the grape crops perhaps suffer from some sort of climatic issue, through to sort of any economic downturn like we just saw a few years ago, where perhaps consumer spending goes down and bottles of wine are one of the things that people buy less of. So it's important to diversify the regional economy and not depend too heavily on it, as important as it may be.
The other thing that builds on that, I think, is, and this is one of my research preoccupations right now, is what happens when downtown is transformed. I mean, the Performing Arts Center and the Spectator facility and Brock moving some of its faculty downtown are all positive things, I think. But when you recreate a space around consumption, around sort of high-end culinary experiences, it transforms the way people identify with that space. And one of the things that I'm concerned about is that there are a lot of people in St. Catharines who will feel perhaps alienated by a boutique-style downtown where there's not something to attract people who are not interested in wine and culture. And I don't mean that as not any kind of culture, but elite culture. So performances, live theater, those kinds of things. And that is one of the things that I'm working on right now, is to try and find out or to think about what does the transformation of downtown St. Catharines mean for people who live here rather than for tourists.
We're talking with Michael Rietmeester and Christopher Folderson, two of the three editors of The World of Niagara Wine from Wilfrid Laurier University Press. I wanted to talk about the culture of resentment that some parts of Niagara may feel towards the wine industry. It might suggest that not everyone is thrilled with the success of the wine industry here.
You're right. We, Russell Johnson and I, have done research on that, where we've looked at the Grape and Wine Parade and the Grape and Wine Festival, and there is a fair bit of resentment, particularly over the upscale movement of the parade and what many people feel to be the less local feel, the less vernacular feel of the parade and the festival, that, you know, it's not for, and we had people tell us, it's not for us anymore. It's for out-of-town snooty wine people. And that's a quotation. So we do see that, and we do see people who, like I mentioned before, are less than thrilled about the removal of tender fruits and the replacement of those orchards with vineyards, and the movement of land, local land, away from local farmers and toward people who, you know, for lack of a better term, are celebrities or very wealthy, who come in and want to run a winery because it seems like a cool thing to do. But again, that means that there's local changes that people, particularly in Grimsby and Virgil, told us when we interviewed them that are not good, and some of them haven't decided yet if it's a good thing or not.
You touched on the grape aspect of the Grape and Wine Festival. I've always wondered about that. Does the grape aspect make it seem too local a celebration? And in order to market it, if you will, to the masses beyond Niagara's border, if you take grape out, it sounds more upscale. And that's the thinking behind it. We can't have it as a local, for the people who live here, celebration. It's got to be bigger than that in order to be successful.
I think you're right. And I know that I used to live downtown, and one of the things that happened was the year they took the grape out, some of my neighbors decided they weren't going to go anymore because it simply wasn't a... They didn't see it as a family event anymore and saw it as something that was more for upscale out-of-towners. And I think when all of this is captured by Phil McIntosh in the chapter that he wrote, where you get a gate around Montebello Park and suddenly a public space is not so public anymore. And the response to that is, among lots of people that we've talked to, not great. People feel alienated from their own city. Now, is it a good marketing strategy? Maybe. But like anything that gives a benefit, there's always something that diminishes, and that in this case it's local interest. I think, will people go to the parade? Probably, but I wonder what local responses are. And I note that a couple of years ago there was a movement from the organizers of the parade to be more inclusive of local things, and people said, well, that's great, but it's kind of too little and too late. We already feel alienated by this. And as long as it's the wine thing and it's clearly meant for out-of-towners, people to come in and spend money locally, then, you know, sure, that's okay, but it's not for us.
And I think this issue that you've just asked us about is sort of one of many in the book that we've tried to bring to light and discuss, at least initially, in the context of the chapters in the book, where, as we say in our introductory chapter, our book is meant not only to celebrate the growth of the Niagara wine industry and many of its aspects, but also to sort of constructively critique it as well. I mean, it's come with what we call some uneasy tensions. So not only sort of the identity issue associated with grape and wine versus the wine festival as one example, but also, for example, the one we spoke about earlier, where we have manufacturing jobs being replaced by wine and tourism industry jobs, and the fact that they're not necessarily jobs for the same people. And then we have a chapter in which Janet McLaughlin discusses migrant workers and their role, contributions to the wine industry, sort of behind the scenes. And so those three things, among others, are issues that we didn't want to shy away from and make sure people were fully aware of the breadth of issues that have emerged in conjunction with the growth of the wine industry here.
Gentlemen, thank you both for coming in today.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Two of the three editors of a new book titled The World of Niagara Wine, published by Wilfrid Laurier University Press. We heard from Michael Ripmeester and Christopher Fullerton, who, along with Philip Gordon McIntosh, are all faculty members in the Department of Geography at Brock University. That's it for this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFBU-FM 103.7 in St. Catharines. My name is Mike Saunders, and I hope you've enjoyed the show. You can contact me via email anytime at talk@cfbu.ca with show comments and suggestions. Until next week, always remember to have an inquisitive mind.